Hazel couldn't meet her brother's eyes.
"I'll tell you later," she promised, trying to keep her voice from trembling. "Right now, we should rest while we can. Tonight, we cross the Apennines."
Chapter 5. Annabeth. 9 days. As she fell, Annabeth thought about Hesiod, the old Greek poet who'd speculated it would take 9 days to fall from Earth to Tartarus. She hoped Hesiod was wrong. She'd lost track of how long Percy and she had been falling. Hours? A day? It felt like an eternity. They'd been holding hands ever since they dropped into the chasm. Now Percy pulled her close, hugging her tight as they tumbled through absolute darkness. Wind whistled in Annabeth's ears. The air grew hotter and damper, as if they were plummeting into the throat of a massive dragon. Her recently broken ankle throbbed, though she couldn't tell if it was still wrapped in spiderwebs. That cursed monster, Arachne. Despite having been trapped in her own webbing, smashed by a car, and plunged into Tartarus, the spider lady had gotten her revenge. Somehow, her silk had entangled Annabeth's leg and dragged her over the side of the pit, with Percy in tow. Annabeth couldn't imagine that Arachne was still alive, somewhere below them in the darkness. She didn't want to meet that monster again when they reached the bottom. On the bright side, assuming there was a bottom, Annabeth and Percy would probably be flattened on impact, so giant spiders were the least of their worries. She wrapped her arms around Percy and tried not to sob. She'd never expected her life to be easy. Most demigods died young at the hands of terrible monsters. That's the way it had been since ancient times. The Greeks invented tragedy. They knew the greatest heroes didn't get happy endings. Still, this wasn't fair. She'd gone through so much to retrieve that statue of Athena. Just when she'd succeeded, when things had been looking up and she'd been reunited with Percy, they had plunged to their deaths. Even the gods couldn't devise a fate so twisted. But Gaia wasn't like other gods. The Earth Mother was older, more vicious, more bloodthirsty. Annabeth could imagine her laughing as they fell into the depths. Annabeth pressed her lips to Percy's ear.
"I love you."
She wasn't sure he could hear her, but if they died, she wanted those to be her last words. She tried desperately to think of a plan to save them. She was a daughter of Athena. She'd proven herself in the tunnels under Rome, beaten a whole series of challenges with only her wits. But she couldn't think of any way to reverse or even slow their fall. Neither of them had the power to fly. Not like Jason, who could control the wind, or Frank, who could turn into a winged animal. If they reached the bottom at terminal velocity, well, she knew enough science to know it would be terminal. She was seriously wondering whether they could fashion a parachute out of their shirts. That's how desperate she was, when something about their surroundings changed. The darkness took on a gray-red tinge. She realized she could see Percy's hair as she hugged him. The whistling in her ears turned into more of a roar. The air became intolerably hot, permeated with a smell like rotten eggs. Suddenly, the chute they'd been falling through opened into a vast cavern. Maybe half a mile below them, Annabeth could see the bottom. For a moment, she was too stunned to think properly. The entire island of Manhattan could have fit inside this cavern, and she couldn't even see its full extent. Red clouds hung in the air like vaporized blood. The landscape, at least what she could see of it, was rocky black plains, punctuated by jagged mountains and fiery chasms.
To Annabeth's left, the ground dropped off in a series of cliffs, like colossal steps leading deeper into the abyss. The stench of sulfur made it hard to concentrate, but she focused on the ground directly below them and saw a ribbon of glittering black liquid. A river. "Percy!" she yelled in his ear. "Water!" She gestured frantically. Percy's face was hard to read in the dim red light. He looked shell-shocked and terrified, but he nodded as if he understood. Percy could control water, assuming that was water below them. He might be able to cushion their fall somehow. Of course, Annabeth had heard horrible stories about the rivers of the underworld. They could take away your memories or burn your body and soul to ashes. But she decided not to think about that. This was their only chance. The river hurtled toward them. At the last second, Percy yelled defiantly. The water erupted in a massive geyser and swallowed them whole. Chapter 6. Annabeth. The impact didn't kill her, but the cold nearly did. Freezing water shocked the air right out of her lungs. Her limbs turned rigid, and she lost her grip on Percy. She began to sink. Strange wailing sounds filled her ears. Millions of heartbroken voices, as if the river were made of distilled sadness. The voices were worse than the cold. They weighed her down and made her numb.
"What's the point of struggling?" they told her. "You're dead anyway. You'll never leave this place."
She could sink to the bottom and drown, let the river carry her body away. That would be easier. She could just close her eyes. Percy gripped her hand and jolted her back to reality. She couldn't see him in the murky water, but suddenly, she didn't want to die. Together, they kicked upward and broke the surface. Annabeth gasped, grateful for the air, no matter how sulfurous. The water swirled around them, and she realized Percy was creating a whirlpool to buoy them up. Though she couldn't make out their surroundings, she knew this was a river. Rivers had shores.
"Land!" she croaked. "Go sideways!"
Percy looked near dead with exhaustion. Usually, water reinvigorated him. But not this water. Controlling it must have taken every bit of his strength. The whirlpool began to dissipate. Annabeth hooked one arm around his waist and struggled across the current. The river worked against her. Thousands of weeping voices whispering in her ears, getting inside her brain.
"Life is despair," they said. "Everything is pointless, and then you die."
"Pointless," Percy murmured. His teeth chattered from the cold. He stopped swimming and began to sink.
"Percy!" she shrieked. "The river is messing with your mind. It's the Cocytus, the river of lamentation. It's made of pure misery."
"Misery," he agreed.
"Fight it!"
She kicked and struggled, trying to keep both of them afloat. Another cosmic joke for Gia to laugh at. Annabeth dies trying to keep her boyfriend, the son of Poseidon, from drowning. "Not going to happen, you hag," Annabeth thought. She hugged Percy tighter and kissed him.
"Tell me about New Rome," she demanded. "What were your plans for us?"
"New Rome, for us."
"Yes, seaweed brain. You said we could have a future there. Tell me."
Annabeth had never wanted to leave Camp Half-Blood. It was the only real home she'd ever known. But days ago, on the Argo II, Percy had told her that he imagined a future for the two of them among the Roman demigods. In their city of New Rome, veterans of the Legion could settle down safely, go to college, get married, and even have kids.
"Architecture," Percy murmured.
The fog started to clear from his eyes.
"Thought you'd like the houses, the parks. There's one street with all these cool fountains."
Annabeth started making progress against the current. Her limbs felt like bags of wet sand, but Percy was helping her now. She could see the dark line of the shore about a stone's throw away.
"College,"
she gasped.
"Could we go there together?"
Yeah,
he agreed, a little more confidently.
"What would you study, Percy?"
"Dunno," he admitted.
"Marine science," she suggested. "Oceanography?"
"Surfing?"
he asked. She laughed, and the sound sent a shockwave through the water. The wailing faded to background noise. Annabeth wondered if anyone had ever laughed in Tartarus before. Just a pure, simple laugh of pleasure. She doubted it. She used the last of her strength to reach the riverbank. Her feet dug into the sandy bottom. She and Percy hauled themselves ashore, shivering and gasping, and collapsed on the dark sand. Annabeth wanted to curl up next to Percy and go to sleep. She wanted to shut her eyes, hope all of this was just a bad dream, and wake up to find herself back on the Argo II, safe with her friends. Well, as safe as a demigod can ever be. But no. They were really in Tartarus. At their feet, the river Cocytus roared past, a flood of liquid wretchedness. The sulfurous air stung Annabeth's lungs and prickled her skin. When she looked at her arms, she saw they were already covered with an angry rash. She tried to sit up and gasped in pain. The beach wasn't sand. They were sitting on a field of jagged black glass chips, some of which were now embedded in Annabeth's palms. So the air was acid, the water was misery, the ground was broken glass. Everything here was designed to hurt and kill. Annabeth took a rattling breath and wondered if the voices in the Cocytus were right. Maybe fighting for survival was pointless. They would be dead within the hour. Next to her, Percy coughed.
"This place smells like my ex-stepfather."
Annabeth managed a weak smile. She'd never met Smelly Gabe, but she'd heard enough stories. She loved Percy for trying to lift her spirits. If she'd fallen into Tartarus by herself, Annabeth thought, she would have been doomed. After all she'd been through beneath Rome, finding the Athena Parthenos, this was simply too much. She would have curled up and cried until she became another ghost, melting into the Cocytus. But she wasn't alone. She had Percy, and that meant she couldn't give up. She forced herself to take stock. Her foot was still wrapped in its makeshift cast of board and bubble wrap, still tangled in cobwebs. But when she moved it, it didn't hurt. The ambrosia she'd eaten in the tunnels under Rome must have finally mended her bones. Her backpack was gone, lost during the fall, or maybe washed away in the river. She hated losing Daedalus's laptop, with all its fantastic programs and data. But she had worse problems. Her celestial bronze dagger was missing, the weapon she'd carried since she was 7 years old. The realization almost broke her, but she couldn't let herself dwell on it. Time to grieve later. What else did they have? No food, no water, basically no supplies at all. Yep, off to a promising start. Annabeth glanced at Percy. He looked pretty bad. His dark hair was plastered across his forehead, his t-shirt ripped to shreds. His fingers were scraped raw from holding on to that ledge before they fell. Most worrisome of all, he was shivering, and his lips were blue.
"We should keep moving, or we'll get hypothermia," Annabeth said. "Can you stand?"
He nodded. They both struggled to their feet. Annabeth put her arm around his waist, though she wasn't sure who was supporting whom. She scanned their surroundings. Above, she saw no sign of the tunnel they'd fallen down. She couldn't even see the cavern roof. Just blood-colored clouds floating in the hazy gray air. It was like staring through a thin mix of tomato soup and cement. The black glass beach stretched inland about 50 yards, then dropped off the edge of a cliff. From where she stood, Annabeth couldn't see what was below, but the edge flickered with red light, as if illuminated by huge fires. A distant memory tugged at her. Something about Tartarus and fire. Before she could think too much about it, Percy inhaled sharply.
"Look," he pointed downstream. 100 feet away, a familiar-looking baby blue Italian car had crashed headfirst into the sand. It looked just like the Fiat that had smashed into Arachne and sent her plummeting into the pit. Annabeth hoped she was wrong, but how many Italian sports cars could there be in Tartarus? Part of her didn't want to go anywhere near it, but she had to find out. She gripped Percy's hand, and they stumbled toward the wreckage. One of the car's tires had come off and was floating in a backwater eddy of the Cocytus. The Fiat's windows had shattered, sending brighter glass like frosting across the dark beach. Under the crushed hood lay the tattered, glistening remains of a giant silk cocoon, the trap that Annabeth had tricked Arachne into weaving. It was unmistakably empty. Slash marks in the sand made a trail downriver, as if something heavy, with multiple legs, had scuttled into the darkness. "She's alive!"
Annabeth was so horrified, so outraged by the unfairness of it all, she had to suppress the urge to throw up.
"It's Tartarus," Percy said. "Monster home court. Down here, maybe they can't be killed."
He gave Annabeth an embarrassed look, as if realizing he wasn't helping team morale.
"Or maybe she's badly wounded and she crawled away to die."
"Let's go with that,"
Annabeth agreed. Percy was still shivering. Annabeth wasn't feeling any warmer either, despite the hot, sticky air. The glass cuts on her hands were still bleeding, which was unusual for her. Normally, she healed fast. Her breathing got more and more labored.
"This place is killing us," she said. "I mean, it's literally going to kill us, unless... Tartarus. Fire."
That distant memory came into focus. She gazed inland toward the cliff, illuminated by flames from below. It was an absolutely crazy idea, but it might be their only chance.
"Unless what?" Percy prompted. "You've got a brilliant plan, haven't you?"
"It's a plan," Annabeth murmured. "I don't know about brilliant. We need to find the River of Fire."
Chapter 7. Annabeth.
When they reached the ledge, Annabeth was sure she'd sign their death warrants. The cliff dropped more than 80 feet. At the bottom stretched a nightmarish version of the Grand Canyon, a river of fire cutting a path through a jagged obsidian crevasse, the glowing red current casting horrible shadows across the cliff faces. Even from the top of the canyon, the heat was intense. The chill of the river Cocytus hadn't left Annabeth's bones, but now her face felt raw and sunburned. Every breath took more effort, as if her chest was filled with styrofoam peanuts. The cuts on her hands bled more rather than less. Annabeth's foot, which had been almost healed, seemed to be re-injuring itself. She'd taken off her makeshift cast, but now she regretted it. Each step made her wince. Assuming they could make it down to the fiery river, which she doubted, her plan seemed certifiably insane. Percy examined the cliff. He pointed to a tiny fissure running diagonally from the edge to the bottom.
We can try that ledge there. Might be able to climb down.
He didn't say they'd be crazy to try. He managed to sound hopeful. Annabeth was grateful for that, but she also worried that she was leading him to his doom. Of course, if they stayed here, they would die anyway. Blisters had started to form on their arms from exposure to the Tartarus air. The whole environment was about as healthy as a nuclear blast zone. Percy went first. The ledge was barely wide enough to allow a toehold. Their hands clawed for any crack in the glassy rock. Every time Annabeth put pressure on her bad foot, she wanted to yelp. She'd ripped off the sleeves of her t-shirt and used the cloth to wrap her bloody palms, but her fingers were still slippery and weak. A few steps below her, Percy grunted as he reached for another handhold.
So, what is this fire river called?
The Phlegethon, she said. You should concentrate on going down.
The Phlegethon?
He shinnied along the edge. They'd made it roughly a third of the way down the cliff, still high enough up to die if they fell.
Sounds like a marathon for hawking spitballs.
Please don't make me laugh, she said.
Just trying to keep things light.
Thanks,
she grunted, nearly missing the ledge with her bad foot.
I'll have a smile on my face as I plummet to my death.
They kept going, one step at a time. Annabeth's eyes stung with sweat. Her arms trembled. But to her amazement, they finally made it to the bottom of the cliff. When she reached the ground, she stumbled. Percy caught her. She was alarmed by how feverish his skin felt. Red boils had erupted on his face, so he looked like a smallpox victim. Her own vision was blurry. Her throat felt blistered, and her stomach was clenched tighter than a fist. We have to hurry, she thought.
Just to the river,
she told Percy, trying to keep the panic out of her voice.
We can do this.
They staggered over slick glass ledges around massive boulders, avoiding stalagmites that would have impaled them with any slip of the foot. Their tattered clothes steamed from the heat of the river, but they kept going until they crumpled to their knees at the banks of the Phlegethon.
We have to drink, Annabeth said.
Percy swayed, his eyes half closed. It took him a three count to respond.
Drink fire?
The Phlegethon flows from Hades' realm down into Tartarus.
Annabeth could barely talk. Her throat was closing up from the heat and the acidic air.
The river is used to punish the wicked, but also, some legends call it the River of Healing.
Some legends?
Annabeth swallowed, trying to stay conscious.
The Phlegethon keeps the wicked in one piece so that they can endure the torments of the fields of punishment. I think it might be the underworld equivalent of ambrosia and nectar.
Percy winced as cinders sprayed from the river, curling around his face.
But it's fire. How can we...
Like this.
Annabeth thrust her hands into the river.
Stupid?
Yes. But she was convinced they had no choice. If they waited any longer, they would pass out and die. Better to try something foolish and hope it worked. On first contact, the fire wasn't painful. It felt cold, which probably meant it was so hot it was overloading Annabeth's nerves. Before she could change her mind, she cupped the fiery liquid in her palms and raised it to her mouth. She expected a taste like gasoline. It was so much worse. Once, at a restaurant back in San Francisco, she'd made the mistake of tasting a ghost chili pepper that came with a plate of Indian food. After barely nibbling it, she thought her respiratory system was going to implode. Drinking from the Phlegathon was like gulping down a ghost chili smoothie. Her sinuses filled with liquid flame. Her mouth felt like it was being deep-fried. Her eyes shed boiling tears, and every pore on her face popped. She collapsed, gagging and retching, her whole body shaking violently.
Annabeth!
Percy grabbed her arms and just managed to stop her from rolling into the river. The convulsions passed. She took a ragged breath and managed to sit up. She felt horribly weak and nauseous, but her next breath came more easily. The blisters on her arms were starting to fade.
It worked, she croaked. Percy, you've got a drink.
His eyes rolled up in his head, and he slumped against her. Desperately, she cupped more fire in her palm. Ignoring the pain, she dripped the liquid into Percy's mouth. He didn't respond. She tried again, pouring a whole handful down his throat. This time he spluttered and coughed. Annabeth held him as he trembled, the magical fire coursing through his system. His fever disappeared. His boils faded. He managed to sit up and smack his lips.
Ugh,
he said.
Spicy, yet disgusting.
Annabeth laughed weakly. She was so relieved, she felt lightheaded.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
You saved us.
For now, she said. The problem is, we're still in Tartarus.
Percy blinked. He looked around as if just coming to terms with where they were.
Holy Hera, I never thought... Well, I'm not sure what I thought. Maybe that Tartarus was empty space, a pit with no bottom. But this is a real place.
Annabeth recalled the landscape she'd seen while they fell, a series of plateaus leading ever downward into the gloom.
We haven't seen all of it, she warned. This could be just the first tiny part of the abyss, like the front steps.
The welcome mat, Percy muttered.
They both gazed up at the blood-colored clouds swirling in the gray haze. No way would they have the strength to climb back up that cliff, even if they wanted to. Now there were only two choices, downriver or upriver, skirting the banks of the Phlegathon.
We'll find a way out, Percy said. The doors of death.
Annabeth shuddered. She remembered what Percy had said just before they fell into Tartarus. He'd made Nico D'Angelo promise to lead the Argo II to Epirus, to the mortal side of the Doors of Death.
We'll see you there, Percy had said.
That idea seemed even crazier than drinking fire. How could the two of them wander through Tartarus and find the Doors of Death? They'd barely been able to stumble 100 yards in this poisonous place without dying.
We have to, Percy said. Not just for us, for everybody we love. The doors have to be closed on both sides, or the monsters will just keep coming through. Gia's forces will overrun the world.
Annabeth knew he was right. Still, when she tried to imagine a plan that could succeed, The logistics overwhelmed her. They had no way of locating the doors. They didn't know how much time it would take, or even if time flowed at the same speed in Tartarus. How could they possibly synchronize a meeting with their friends? And Nico had mentioned a legion of Gia's strongest monsters guarding the doors on the Tartarus side. Annabeth and Percy couldn't exactly launch a frontal assault. She decided not to mention any of that. They both knew the odds were bad. Besides, after swimming in the river Cocytus, Annabeth had heard enough whining and moaning to last a lifetime. She promised herself never to complain again. Well, she took a deep breath, grateful at least that her lungs didn't hurt. If we stay close to the river, we'll have a way to heal ourselves. If we go downstream... It happened so fast. Annabeth would have been dead if she'd been on her own. Percy's eyes locked on something behind her. Annabeth spun as a massive, dark shape hurtled down at her. A snarling, monstrous blob with spindly barbed legs and glinting eyes. She had time to think. Arachne. But she was frozen in terror, her senses smothered by the sickly sweet smell. Then she heard the familiar shink of Percy's ballpoint pen transforming into a sword. His blade swept over her head in a glowing bronze arc. A horrible wail echoed through the canyon. Annabeth stood there, stunned, as yellow dust, the remains of Arachne, rained around her like tree pollen.
You okay?
Percy scanned the cliffs and boulders, alert for more monsters, but nothing else appeared. The golden dust of the spider settled on the obsidian rocks. Annabeth stared at her boyfriend in amazement. Riptide's celestial bronze blade glowed even brighter in the gloom of Tartarus. As it passed through the thick, hot air, it made a defiant hiss like a riled snake.
She would have killed me, Annabeth stammered.
Percy kicked the dust on the rocks, his expression grim and dissatisfied.
She died too easy, considering how much torture she put you through. She deserved worse.
Annabeth couldn't argue with that, but the hard edge in Percy's voice made her unsettled. She'd never seen someone get so angry or vengeful on her behalf. It almost made her glad Arachne had died quickly.
How did you move so fast?
Percy shrugged.
Gotta watch each other's backs, right? Now, you were saying, downstream?
Annabeth nodded, still in a daze. The yellow dust dissipated on the rocky shore, turning to steam. At least now they knew monsters could be killed in Tartarus, though she had no idea how long Arachne would remain dead. Annabeth didn't plan on staying long enough to find out.
Yeah, downstream, she managed. If the river comes from the upper levels of the underworld, it should flow deeper into Tartarus.
So it leads into more dangerous territory, Percy finished. Which is probably where the doors are. Lucky us.
Chapter 8. Annabeth. They'd only traveled a few hundred yards when Annabeth heard voices. Annabeth plodded along, half in a stupor, trying to form a plan. Since she was a daughter of Athena, plans were supposed to be her specialty, but it was hard to strategize with her stomach growling and her throat baking. The fiery water of the Phlegethon may have healed her and given her strength, but it didn't do anything for her hunger or thirst. The river wasn't about making you feel good, Annabeth guessed. It just kept you going so you could experience more excruciating pain. Her head started to droop with exhaustion. Then she heard them. Female voices, having some sort of argument. And she was instantly alert. She whispered,
Percy, down.
She pulled him behind the nearest boulder, wedging herself so close against the riverbank that her shoes almost touched the river's fire. On the other side, in the narrow path between the river and the cliffs, voices snarled, getting louder as they approached from upstream. Annabeth tried to steady her breathing. The voices sounded vaguely human, but that meant nothing. She assumed anything in Tartarus was their enemy. She didn't know how the monsters could have failed to spot them already. Besides, monsters could smell demigods, especially powerful ones like Percy, son of Poseidon. Annabeth doubted that hiding behind a boulder would do any good when the monsters caught their scent. Still, as the monsters got nearer, their voices didn't change in tone. Their uneven footsteps, scrap, clump, scrap, clump, didn't get any faster.
"Soon?"
one of them asked in a raspy voice, as if she'd been gargling in the phlegathon.
"Oh my gods,"
said another voice. This one sounded much younger and much more human, like a teenaged mortal girl getting exasperated with her friends at the mall. For some reason, she sounded familiar to Annabeth.
"You guys are totally annoying. I told you, it's like 3 days from here."
Percy gripped Annabeth's wrist. He looked at her with alarm, as if he recognized the mall girl's voice too. There was a chorus of growling and grumbling. The creatures, maybe half a dozen, Annabeth guessed, had paused just on the other side of the boulder. But still, they gave no indication that they'd caught the demigod's scent. Annabeth wondered if demigods didn't smell the same in Tartarus, or if the other scents here were so powerful they masked a demigod's aura.
"I wonder,"
said a third voice, gravelly and ancient like the first,
"if perhaps you do not know the way, young one."
"Oh, shut your fang hole, Sir Effany," said the mall girl. "When's the last time you escaped to the mortal world? I was there a couple of years ago. I know the way. Besides, I understand what we're facing up there. You don't have a clue."
"The Earth Mother did not make you boss,"
shrieked a fourth voice. More hissing, scuffling, and feral moans, like giant alley cats fighting. At last, the one called Seraphine yelled,
"Enough!"
The scuffling died down.
"We will follow for now," Seraphine said. "But if you do not lead us well, if we find you have lied about the summons of Gia..."
"I don't lie," snapped the mall girl. "Believe me, I've got good reason to get into this battle. I have some enemies to devour, and you'll feast on the blood of heroes. Just leave one special morsel for me, the one named Percy Jackson."
Annabeth fought down a snarl of her own. She forgot about her fear. She wanted to jump over the boulder and slash the monsters to dust with her knife. Except she didn't have it anymore.
"Believe me," said the mall girl. "Gia has called us, and we're going to have so much fun. Before this war is over, mortals and demigods will tremble at the sound of my name. Kelly!"
Annabeth almost yelped aloud. She glanced at Percy. Even in the red light of the phlegathon, his face seemed waxy.
"Empusai," she mouthed. "Vampires."
Percy nodded grimly. She remembered Kelly. 2 years ago, at Percy's freshman orientation, he and their friend Rachel Dare had been attacked by Empusai, disguised as cheerleaders. One of them had been Kelly. Later, the same Empusa had attacked them in Daedalus's workshop. Annabeth had stabbed her in the back and sent her here, to Tartarus. The creatures shuffled off, their voice getting fainter. Annabeth crept to the edge of the boulder and risked a glimpse. Sure enough, five women staggered along on mismatched legs. Mechanical bronze on the left, shaggy and cloven-hooved on the right. Their hair was made of fire, their skin as white as bone. Most of them wore tattered ancient Greek dresses, except for the one in the lead, Kelly, who wore a burned and torn blouse with a short pleated skirt, her cheerleader's outfit. Annabeth gritted her teeth. She had faced a lot of bad monsters over the years, but she hated Empusai more than most. In addition to their nasty claws and fangs, they had a powerful ability to manipulate the mist. They could change shape and charm speak, tricking mortals into letting down their guard. Men were especially susceptible. The Empusa's favorite tactic was to make a guy fall in love with her, then drink his blood and devour his flesh. Not a great first date. Kelly had almost killed Percy. She had manipulated Annabeth's oldest friend, Luke, urging him to commit darker and darker deeds in the name of Kronos. Annabeth really wished she still had her dagger. Percy rose.
"They're heading for the doors of death," he murmured. "You know what that means?"
Annabeth didn't want to think about it. But sadly, this squad of flesh-eating horror show women might be the closest thing to good luck they were going to get in Tartarus.
"Yeah," she said. "We need to follow them."
Chapter 9. Leo. Leo spent the night wrestling with a 40-foot-tall Athena. Ever since they'd brought the statue aboard, Leo had been obsessed with figuring out how it worked. He was sure it had primo powers. There had to be a secret switch or a pressure plate or something. He was supposed to be sleeping, but he just couldn't. He spent hours crawling over the statue, which took up most of the lower deck. Athena's feet stuck into sickbay, so you had to squeeze past her ivory toes if you wanted some Advil. Her body ran the length of the port corridor, her outstretched hand jutting into the engine room, offering the life-sized figure of Nike that stood in her palm like, "Here, have some victory." Athena's serene face took up most of the aft Pegasus stables, which were fortunately unoccupied. If Leo were a magic horse, he wouldn't have wanted to live in a stall with an oversized goddess of wisdom staring at him. The statue was wedged tight in the corridor, so Leo had to climb over the top and wriggle under her limbs, searching for levers and buttons. As usual, he found nothing. He'd done some research on the statue. He knew it was made from a hollow wooden frame covered in ivory and gold, which explained why it was so light. It was in pretty good shape, considering it was more than 2,000 years old, had been pillaged from Athens, toted to Rome, and secretly stored in a spider's cavern for most of the past 2 millennia. Magic must have kept it intact, Leo figured, combined with really good craftsmanship. Annabeth had said, well, he tried not to think about Annabeth. He still felt guilty about her and Percy falling into Tartarus. Leo knew it was his fault. He should have gotten everyone safely on board the Argo II before he started securing the statue. He should have realized the cavern floor was unstable. Still, moping around wasn't going to get Percy and Annabeth back. He had to concentrate on fixing the problems he could fix. Anyway, Annabeth had said the statue was the key to defeating Gia. It could heal the rift between Greek and Roman demigods. Leo figured there had to be more to it than just symbolism. Maybe Athena's eyes shot lasers, or the snake behind her shield could spit poison. Or maybe the smaller figure of Nike came to life and busted out some ninja moves. Leo could think of all kinds of fun things the statue might do if he had designed it. But the more he examined it, the more frustrated he got. The Athena Parthenos radiated magic. Even he could feel that. But it didn't seem to do anything except look impressive. The ship careened to one side, taking evasive maneuvers. Leo resisted the urge to run to the helm. Jason, Piper, and Frank were on duty with Hazel now. They could handle whatever was going on. Besides, Hazel had insisted on taking the wheel to guide them through the secret pass that the magic goddess had told her about. Leo hoped Hazel was right about the long detour north. He didn't trust this Hecate lady. He didn't see why such a creepy goddess would suddenly decide to be helpful. Of course, he didn't trust magic in general. That's why he was having so much trouble with the Athena Parthenos. It had no moving parts. Whatever it did, it apparently operated on pure sorcery, and Leo didn't appreciate that. He wanted it to make sense, like a machine. Finally, he got too exhausted to think straight. He curled up with a blanket in the engine room and listened to the soothing hum of the generators. Buford, the mechanical table, sat in the corner on sleep mode, making little steamy snores. Shh. Pff. Shh. Pff. Leo liked his quarters okay, but he felt safest here in the heart of the ship, in a room filled with mechanisms he knew how to control. Besides, maybe if he spent more time close to the Athena Parthenos, he would eventually soak in its secrets. "It's you or me, big lady," he murmured as he pulled the blanket up to his chin. "You're gonna cooperate eventually." He closed his eyes and slept. Unfortunately, that meant dreams. He was running for his life through his mother's old workshop, where she died in a fire when Leo was 8. He wasn't sure what was chasing him, but he sensed it closing fast. Something large and dark and full of hate. He stumbled into workbenches, knocked over toolboxes, and tripped on electrical cords. He spotted the exit and sprinted toward it, but a figure loomed in front of him. A woman in robes of dry, swirling earth, her face covered in a veil of dust.
"Where are you going, little hero?" Gia asked. "Stay and meet my favorite son."
Leo darted to the left, but the Earth Goddess's laughter followed him.
"The night your mother died, I warned you. I said the fates would not allow me to kill you then. But now you have chosen your path. Your death is near, Leo Valdez."
He ran into a drafting table, his mother's old workstation. The wall behind it was decorated with Leo's crayon drawings. He sobbed in desperation and turned, but the thing pursuing him now stood in his path, a colossal being wrapped in shadows, its shape vaguely humanoid, its head almost scraping the ceiling 20 feet above. Leo's hands burst into flame. He blasted the giant, but the darkness consumed his fire. Leo reached for his tool belt. The pockets were sewn shut. He tried to speak, to say anything that would save his life, but he couldn't make a sound, as if the air had been stolen from his lungs.
"My son will not allow any fires tonight," Gia said from the depths of the warehouse. "He is the void that consumes all magic, the cold that consumes all fire, the silence that consumes all speech."
Leo wanted to shout, "And I'm the dude that's all out of here!" His voice didn't work, so he used his feet. He dashed to the right, ducking under the shadowy giant's grasping hands, and burst through the nearest doorway. Suddenly, he found himself at Camp Half-Blood, except the camp was in ruins. The cabins were charred husks. Burned fields smoldered in the moonlight. The dining pavilion had collapsed into a pile of white rubble, and the big house was on fire, its windows glowing like demon eyes. Leo kept running, sure the shadow giant was still behind him. He wove around the bodies of Greek and Roman demigods. He wanted to check if they were alive. He wanted to help them. But somehow he knew he was running out of time. He jogged toward the only living people he saw, a group of Romans standing at the volleyball pit. Two centurions leaned casually on their javelins, chatting with a tall, skinny blonde guy in a purple toga. Leo stumbled. It was that freak Octavian, the augur from Camp Jupiter, who was always screaming for war. Octavian turned to face him, but he seemed to be in a trance. His features were slack, his eyes closed. When he spoke, it was in Gia's voice.
"This cannot be prevented. The Romans move east from New York. They advance on your camp, and nothing can slow them down."
Leo was tempted to punch Octavian in the face. Instead, he kept running. He climbed Half-Blood Hill. At the summit, lightning had splintered the giant pine tree. He faltered to a stop. The back of the hill was shorn away. Beyond it, the entire world was gone. Leo saw nothing but clouds far below, a rolling silver carpet under the dark sky. A sharp voice said,
"Well?"
Leo flinched. At the shattered pine tree, a woman knelt at a cave entrance that had cracked open between the tree's roots. The woman wasn't Gia. She looked more like a living Athena Parthenos, with the same golden robes and bare ivory arms. When she rose, Leo almost stumbled off the edge of the world. Her face was regally beautiful, with high cheekbones, large dark eyes, and braided licorice-colored hair piled in a fancy Greek hairdo, set with a spiral of emeralds and diamonds so that it reminded Leo of a Christmas tree. Her expression radiated pure hatred. Her lip curled. Her nose wrinkled.
"The Tinkerer God's child," she sneered. "You are no threat, but I suppose my vengeance must start somewhere. Make your choice."
Leo tried to speak, but he was about to crawl out of his skin with panic. Between this hate queen and the giant chasing him, he had no idea what to do.
"He'll be here soon," the woman warned. "My dark friend will not give you the luxury of a choice. It's the cliff or the cave, boy."
Suddenly, Leo understood what she meant. He was cornered. He could jump off the cliff, but that was suicide. Even if there was land under those clouds, he would die in the fall. Or maybe he would just keep falling forever. But the cave. He stared at the dark opening between the tree roots. It smelled of rot and death. He heard bodies shuffling inside, voices whispering in the shadows. The cave was the home of the dead. If he went down there, he would never come back.
"Yes," the woman said. Around her neck hung a strange bronze and emerald pendant, like a circular labyrinth.
Her eyes were so angry, Leo finally understood why mad was a word for crazy. This lady had been driven nuts by hatred.
"The House of Hades awaits. You will be the first puny rodent to die in my maze. You have only one chance to escape, Leo Valdez. Take it."
She gestured toward the cliff.
"You're bonkers," he managed.
That was the wrong thing to say. She seized his wrist.
"Perhaps I should kill you now, before my dark friend arrives?"
Steps shook the hillside. The giant was coming, wrapped in shadows, huge and heavy and bent on murder.
"Have you heard of dying in a dream, boy?" the woman asked. "It is possible at the hands of a sorceress."
Leo's arm started to smoke. The woman's touch was acid. He tried to free himself, but her grip was like steel. He opened his mouth to scream. The massive shape of the giant loomed over him, obscured by layers of black smoke. The giant raised his fist, and a voice cut through the dream. "Leo!" Jason was shaking his shoulder. "Hey, man, why are you hugging Nike?" Leo's eyes fluttered open. His arms were wrapped around the human-sized statue in Athena's hand. He must have been thrashing in his sleep. He clung to the victory goddess like he used to cling to his pillow when he had nightmares as a kid. Man, that had been so embarrassing in the foster homes. He disentangled himself and sat up, rubbing his face.
"Nothing," he muttered. "We were just cuddling. What's going on?"
Jason didn't tease him. That's one thing Leo appreciated about his friend. Jason's ice-blue eyes were level and serious. The little scar on his mouth twitched like it always did when he had bad news to share. "We made it through the mountains," he said. "We're almost to Bologna. You should join us in the mess hall. Nico has new information." Chapter 10. Leo. Leo had designed the mess hall's walls to show real-time scenes from Camp Half-Blood. At first, he had thought that was a pretty awesome idea. Now he wasn't so sure. The scenes from back home, the campfire sing-alongs, dinners at the pavilion, volleyball games outside the big house, just seemed to make his friends sad. The farther they got from Long Island, the worse it got. The time zones kept changing, making Leo feel the distance every time he looked at the walls. Here in Italy, the sun had just come up. Back at Camp Half-Blood, it was the middle of the night. Torches sputtered at the cabin doorways. Moonlight glittered on the waves of Long Island Sound. The beach was covered in footprints, as if a big crowd had just left. With a start, Leo realized that yesterday, last night, whatever, had been the 4th of July. They'd missed Camp Half-Blood's annual party at the beach, with awesome fireworks prepared by Leo's siblings in Cabin 9. He decided not to mention that to the crew, but he hoped their buddies back home had had a good celebration. They needed something to keep their spirits up, too. He remembered the images he'd seen in his dream. The camp in ruins, littered with bodies. Octavian standing at the volleyball pit, casually talking in Gia's voice. He stared down at his eggs and bacon. He wished he could turn off the wall videos. "So," Jason said, "now that we're here..." He sat at the head of the table, kind of by default. Since they'd lost Annabeth, Jason had done his best to act as the group's leader. Having been Preeter back at Camp Jupiter, he was probably used to that, but Leo could tell his friend was stressed. His eyes were more sunken than usual. His blonde hair was uncharacteristically messy, like he'd forgotten to comb it. Leo glanced at the others around the table. Hazel was bleary-eyed, too, but of course, she'd been up all night guiding the ship through the mountains. Her curly, cinnamon-colored hair was tied back in a bandana, which gave her a commando look that Leo found kind of hot, and then immediately felt guilty about. Next to her sat her boyfriend, Frank Jong, dressed in black workout pants and a Roman tourist t-shirt that said, "Ciao." Was that even a word? Frank's old centurion badge was pinned to his shirt. Despite the fact that the demigods of the Argo II were now public enemies numbers 1 through 7 back at Camp Jupiter. His grim expression just reinforced his unfortunate resemblance to a sumo wrestler. Then there was Hazel's half-brother, Nico D'Angelo. Dang, that kid gave Leo the freaky deekies. He sat back in his leather aviator jacket, his black t-shirt and jeans, that wicked silver skull ring on his finger, and the Stygian sword at his side. His tufts of black hair stuck up in curls like baby bat wings.